The Living and the Dead, Tales of Loss and Rebirth from Irish Nature by Conor O'Brien, was Richard's suggested nature book for Christmas. However, as we barely scratched the surface of what we had to talk about with Conor, we asked him back today and he joins us now on the line. Hello, Conor, how are you?
I'm not too bad, Derek. Thank you very much for having me on.
We're delighted to have you back. Did you celebrate Robbie Burton's night yourself last night?
I can't say I did, no. I wasn't even aware that Robbie Burns' night was on, I'm afraid. My knowledge of Scottish festivals is a bit lacking. But it sounds like it was a spectacular celebration and sounds like there was some wonderful food. I was wondering what a Cullen skink was. I thought initially it was a species of lizard, but I'm glad that was clarified and that it was actually a delicacy. So sounds interesting.
Well, there you go now. A skink is the Scottish word for soup. Sad Cullen is the name of the town. So you could have other skinks. You could have a Montrose skink if we were to make a soup out here.
A Montrose stink. Anyway, The Living and the Dead, Tales of Loss and Rebirth from Irish Nature by Conor O'Brien. So what's it all about?
So basically, Derek, the book is split into two halves. I've long been interested in the wildlife that we've lost in Ireland and the species that we no longer have. So I wanted to dedicate half of the book to that, to looking at some of the species that have been lost to Ireland over the past few hundred years and some of the reasons for that. And just so not to have it all doom and gloom, I thought I would kind of counterbalance that a little bit by looking at some of the species that have come back, either that have either been reintroduced, that have recolonized Ireland naturally, like the great spotted woodpecker, or some species that were basically forced back almost to the brink, the likes of the pine marten, and that have managed to make a recovery in more recent years. So that was basically the idea behind the book. So 14 species in total, split into two sections of seven. And in each section, I go kind of looking for the species, or indeed, in the case of species that we've lost, looking for places that where they once roamed the countryside.
Conor, it's Niall here. I think you've done a really good job. It's a wonderful book. Congratulations on it. I think you went about it exactly the right way, because you start with the things that we've lost out on. I had this sense of sadness and genuine loss when reading that, all the creatures that I probably will never see again in Ireland. But then you then go into the more optimistic side, how nature can be resilient. So you leave us with a strong message of hope. Was that a conscious decision when you were planning your book?
Absolutely, yeah. That was definitely what I wanted to convey, really, I suppose, just to, like you said, Niall, to give that sense of loss. Like, it's incredible to think that, like, we once had grey wolves in our hills and we once had grey hawks around our coast. But in the case, it's highly unlikely that we'll ever see that again. And in the case of the great hawk, it'll never happen, unfortunately. That's a species that's lost to the whole world. We also had corn buntings on our farmland until relatively recently. Indeed, some of you in that studio might well have heard or have seen them. I'm never got a chance to see a corn bunting or to hear one in Ireland, and I probably never will. But I have been able to see great spotted woodpeckers. I have been able to see pine martens, and I've been able to see white-tailed eagles, and that's incredible. And that's something that would have been unthinkable when I was a child. So it just shows that positive change can happen, and it can happen over the course of one lifetime.
And you have a very literary title to your book, The Living and the Dead. They're the very last lines of The Dead, James Joyce's short story. His soul swooned slowly as he heard the snow falling faintly through the universe, and faintly falling like the descent of their last end upon all the living and the dead. Presumably that was a conscious thing you did too.
Believe it or not, it actually wasn't. I took it from the prayer. I was kind of more of a religious inspiration, but obviously it's not a religious work. It's a work of natural history. But
what prayer? What prayer has the living and the dead in it?
He will come again in glory to judge the living and the dead, and his kingdom will have no end.
Exactly. There you go.
So I actually, would you believe, I have read The Dead by James Joyce. I've read Dubliners, but it's been a very, very long time. So but would you believe that reference actually went completely over my head?
Well, there you are. So, I was very impressed with your literary ability.
Thank you very much.
I was very interested in all the species you have. And the mountain ringlet was one that I actually went on a hunt for in the 1970s. Oh, 1975, Whoa. Which is 7 from 12 leaves 5, which is 50 years ago. We went in July, not on Croagh Patrick as you did, but we went up on Mount Brandon down in Kerry. I was doing a teacher's course. We had John Heath, who was the big butterfly man, over from the Biological Record Centre in Britain. I was the head of the Irish Biological Record Centre. That was my first job, and we were doing the teacher's course, and nothing would do him, only that there would surely be mountain ringlets on, why wouldn't they after all be on Mount Brandon, and we could climb up the mountain and look for this. And we spent a whole afternoon with our teachers. In those days, teachers did courses, didn't end at 2 o'clock. We were there till 6:30 climbing up the mountain. And of course, the thing was, it flies for 2 or 3 weeks in July and lays its eggs, and this is how the breeding happens. And of course, little tiny butterflies, it's a really small one, fly not in the rain. And he was of the opinion that the weather had been so bad up those mountains over the general time since it was seen before, that the butterflies had no chance to fly or lay eggs, and that it was the weather what done them in. We had a whole day up the mountain, it was great, but we did not see the mountain ringlet.
That's very interesting. I actually didn't know that you went on an expedition looking for them up there. I knew there had been efforts across different mountains, landscapes in Ireland to try and find them, and without success. And like exactly like you said there, it seems to be that that inclement weather, I mean, for a butterfly that has such a short flying season and a really small window in which to reproduce, and obviously that can't fly in really bad rain or in strong wind, a period of inclement weather can really, really impact their reproductive success. And if you have that over a few successive years, it can really, really devastate the population, especially of a species that's so limited in its range, or would have been so limited in its range when it was thought to have been extant in Ireland.
Yeah, because you were saying that you went up Croagh-Patrick, where there were specimens collected and they were lodged. I mean, it's not a notion that somebody misidentified something or anything like that. The specimens were actually lodged, and they were found in 1854. So this was more than 125 years later I was going looking for it. And then in 1894, they were found on a hill south of Loch Gill in County Sligo. And the last one then was caught in Ireland in 1918, turned up in a butterfly collection in Kent in 1990. We didn't know about that one. And then another one was allegedly caught on Nafan in County Mayo in 1897. So really the records that do exist were for the northern part. So it was Sligo and Mayo that the records that were. So I mean, going down looking for it in Kerry was just because it was a high altitude mountain. It was the same sort of terrain. It was the same sort of grasses that it would need for the caterpillars and that. But there had never actually been any records ever from there. So it would have been a wonderful thing if we had found it, and we had the expert with us who would have told us if it was so. But you didn't have any greater joy on Croagh-Patrick yourself. You have a great account of it in the book.
Yes, I mean, it was, do you know what, it was climbing up Croagh-Patrick was something I always wanted to do anyway, and this just added an extra impetus to it, really, to go somewhere where a species that we once had, where it once lived and possibly even thrived for generations. I mean, like such a small butterfly on living at such kind of higher altitudes, it would have gone overlooked by the vast, vast majority of people.
Connor, I'm glad you picked a nondescript little brown bird, the corn bunting. It's something that people wouldn't give it a second look to. But it is a bird that fascinated me, and I loved your chapter on it because it brings back memories. I used to camp with my wife on the Mullet Peninsula every year, and the familiar sound then was the jingling of a bunch of keys, which was the song of the little corn bunting. And it was ubiquitous there, and of course it is gone now. It always struck me that this was in a sense a victim of the famine, the great famine of the 1840s. Ireland ceased to be a land of tillage, and it became a land of pasture. And of course, the corn bunting loves seeds. It's a ground, it likes grassy things down the ground and that kind of stuff. And of course, with the reduction in the amount of tillage, it lost out heavily and has been declining. And the same is true of the yellowhammer now, that's on the way out slowly, and the twite and lots of things. That is a momentous change. But the corn bunting itself is a lovely little streaky fellow, an interesting character in all kinds of ways. There was a study done in Lancashire, and you found that about 72% of them are monogamous. They have only one partner. But another 18% or something like that were not promiscuous. Promiscuity is loving and leave them, the one night stand. That's promiscuity. It's more having a harem kind of thing, you know, that he goes in for. He has several wives and that thing. But it's, and they're a strange lot. They're very, they're never, you never saw them in those days with the female. But they look alike, of course, but they don't associate much with the female. They're a strange lot. But I'm very glad you included this little fellow. And I've been blaming the famine, but of course I should blame the railways as well. Because the great change in the 1850s in Ireland was that you had mechanised transport now. You had steamships. You could take your cattle in the train to the port and you could take it on sea to Britain and sell it. Whereas before that, you had to drive them and the storms and things would delay the whole process. But suddenly it was possible to sell meat, whereas in the past you lived entirely in cereal. But it's a very interesting insight into the history of Ireland, the little corn bunting.
It is, absolutely. And I mean, it's quite an interesting comparison you've drawn there, Richard, when you look at kind of Ireland post-famine and the change in our agricultural landscapes that followed that. And then obviously that was really what did in the corn bunting. Like you say, we really transitioned kind of from really, like, as we started to move into the 20th century, we really started to transition away from growing cereals. The amount of acreage under crops in that sense really fell quite dramatically. And we started putting a lot more land under grass to sustain cattle. And then that was accompanied by a few other changes as well. So you saw the kind of widespread application of pesticides and insecticides and herbicides across a lot of the Irish farming landscape, which would have killed a lot of the invertebrate food that young corn buntings would need. And then also a lot of the plants that they would depend upon, hedgerows started to decline as well, because you need larger fields, obviously, to sustain larger herds of cattle. And indeed make way for larger machinery. So a lot of the hedgerows between the fields would have been done away with, which would have meant like kind of lost a vital corridor for species like corn buntings that they could use. And also when you're growing grass for silage, it's harvested earlier in the year. So any corn buntings nesting in there would have faced a great risk as well. One of the reasons I wanted to include the corn bunting was because it's a species that ebbed away into extinction so recently. We had corn buntings in the country as late as the 1990s, so well into my lifetime, and there are still people like yourself within living memory who have a living memory with the corn bunting that we haven't yet lost. And, you know, a long way may we retain and cherish that while we still have people who can recall the sound of the corn bunting on the Mullet Peninsula and in various other places in the country. But tragically, you know, there are still species that are related to corn bunting, the likes of the yellowhammer. I'm actually blessed, would you believe, to have yellowhammers in my back garden. I've been delighted to include them in the garden bird survey form, which I'm filling out for our house here in County Meath. Because we live in quite an agricultural area, we are very, very blessed to have yellowhammers in the garden in winter. But they're a very, very hard hit species for many of the same reasons as the corn bunting. And if we don't arrest that decline, they could go the same way, but hopefully it won't happen.
Connor, I think that the main message I take away from your book, the lesson that we have to learn, is that we humans, we need to learn from our mistakes. And I think that when we're looking at the loss of species like the capercaillie, this amazing grouse that used to live in our forests, or fish like the sturgeon, which I never even realised that we had in Ireland once upon a time, the fish, of course, which is famous for producing caviar. At least that people could claim, or we could look back maybe through the benefit of hindsight and say people didn't know any better, or people weren't aware. We don't have that excuse today, do we? We know that we are committing an onslaught on the natural world. We have to learn that actually, while maybe it's too late for the corn bunting, but that yellowhammer, we can save it. I know that's something that's central to the work that both you and I do with Birdwatch Ireland. But also I think that it's, again, as it going back to the idea of optimism, I think that we need to learn that it's not a done deal. We can save these creatures.
Absolutely, yes. And that's, I suppose, some of why I wanted to include some of the stories in the latter half of the book, Niall. So I think where we lost the corn bunting, we still have the grey partridge, for example. That was a species that was very much going the same direction as the corn bunting. As the millennium approached, the situation was looking very, very dire. We were down to maybe 20 or 30 birds, wild grey partridge in the whole country. The ones we had left were captured. They were moved to Loughborough, to an area of restored bog that was basically rehabilitated into the kind of habitat that can sustain that species. And with the help of captive breeding and with reintroduced birds from the continent, we still have grey partridge in Ireland, living in the wild in a very confined area, it has to be said, really kind of clustered into that one area in the Midlands. But we still have them, and long may it remain so. Just to get back to your point, we can't claim ignorance now, as was the case in the past. Obviously, things like extinction, as the further you go back in time into the 1800s, extinction wasn't as understood. The permanency of it wasn't as understood as it is now, which is why species like the great auk were just exploited to the point where they went completely extinct. But no, we have a far greater understanding of that now, a far greater understanding of ecology, of how fragile ecosystems are, of why we need to sustain species, and you know, every species has a place to play in the ecosystems that we have. So hopefully with that greater understanding, we can start to see, you know, a reduction in the number of extinctions, certainly in a country like Ireland, where, you know, so much has already been lost, which is why we should cherish what we still have.
Yeah, it just goes to show, though, when you do actually do as you say, things will improve. I mean, I remember in the record centre in the 1970s, the pine marten was the rarest animal in Ireland, and records of it were absolutely amazing. They weren't to be seen, and people had all kinds of pishrogues about them. It had a nail in its tail, which it reabsorbed after it was dead, and if you could get the nail out before it lost it, it would be a great good luck talisman, and all of this kind of carry on. It was so little known, but then because persecution of it stopped and because more habitat became available for it, it has really recovered. So it does show that, is there a critical mass below which they won't recover? I mean, they can recover from a very small amount left behind if we change the habitat and stop the persecution and make it better for them. So, I mean, that gives us hope that, you know, build it and they'll come. I mean, here's the cranes back again. They came of their own volition. If you like, we brought the woodpeckers, they came back of their own volition as well, because the habitat then suited them, which it hadn't before. They're able to thrive. So, you know, you do end up with a positive vibe from your book, Build It and They'll Come, or We Change Our Ways and the species that aren't quite gone can very well come back.
You mentioned there some of the incredible success stories that we've had over the last few years. I mean, cranes, I mean, that's, who would have thought we'd have breeding cranes again in our lifetimes, you know, a species that's been absent from Ireland for 300 years. Once thought to have been very common on the bogs in the Midlands. Obviously, with the loss of those bogs, and particularly in the case of the crane, with the extensive hunting, a species that was wiped out in Ireland altogether, and for 300 years was completely absent for our landscapes. And now we have them again in very small numbers, and obviously they need strongest of protection to maintain them, but hopefully the population can start to grow and to become self-sustaining, as it has been in the case of the United Kingdom, for example, where there is now a reasonably large population of cranes that is starting to grow. With the case with the great spotted woodpecker, it was another victim of the intense forest clearances that we had in Ireland. You know, between the 1600 and 1800, you really saw the kind of evisceration of a lot of the last great forests in Ireland. And it's likely that the great spotted woodpecker perished during that time. But with the expanding population in Britain, that kind of population pressure is thought to have forced some intrepid woodpeckers across the Irish Sea, and they landed in County Down, where if they were coming from Scotland, and in County Wicklow, where the population probably originated from Wales, and they've been spreading ever since. They've been recorded in pretty much every county in Ireland now, and the population is growing. If you go on websites like Irish Birding, you see reportings of them. Certainly, it feels like every week, if not every day, people are seeing them in their gardens, especially now in winter when they're leaving peanuts out for the birds. I still haven't had one in my garden, unfortunately, here in County Meath, but I'm actually looking out at the peanut feeder at the moment, and I'm hoping someday, some winter, in the not too distant future, we might get one.
Well, Conor, thank you very much indeed. The book again is called The Living and the Dead, Tales of Loss and Rebirth from Irish Nature by Conor O'Brien. Conor, we'll talk to you again soon. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye. Take care.